Today at Reader's Corner, Kurt Anderson, author of Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, a 500-year history. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. For most of its history, America has struggled to maintain a balance between fantasy and fact. According to today's guest, Kurt Anderson, our country is now in a moment where we feel entitled to believe whatever we want, regardless of the evidence. How this happened and why we should be concerned is the subject of his book, Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, a 500-year history. In the book, Mr. Anderson looks back at America's colorful history to understand how the lines between reality and illusion have become dangerously blurred. Today, we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Kurt Anderson. He's the best-selling author of the novels Heyday, Turn of the Century, and True Believers, and the host and co-creator of Studio 360, the Peabody Award-winning public radio show and podcast. He served as editor-in-chief of New York Magazine and is a contributor to Vanity Fair and the New York Times. Mr. Anderson joins us by Skype for this interview. Kurt Anderson, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Happy to be here. Couldn't be happier.
So I read this book and thought, why don't you go back to your publishers and say, hey, look, I know where you're marketing this book. It should be on bookshelves all over America, but it needs to be a companion text to every American history course offered in colleges and universities across the country. Now, that would sell you some books.
It would, yes. So go tell them that. No, I have gotten lots and lots of emails and letters from readers, and some of the most gratifying ones are ones from professors and high school history teachers saying pretty much exactly that.
And you even took on a few professors along the way. We'll get into that later. But I thought that was justice served. So the subtitle of this book is perfect, of course. It says it all, How America Went Haywire. It could have said How America Elected Trump. But you tell us in the intro to the book that this book started long before we knew Trump was even a serious candidate.
It did. I really started thinking about it some years earlier, and then and decided around 2012, 2013, okay, this is my next book. And really got through the whole 500 years of this history. And then I was, you know, in the final stretch when Donald Trump was wrapping up the Republican nomination and realized that he suddenly had barged in to become my exhibit A for my argument. So it was, he showed up as kind of the embodiment of almost all of my arguments. And so there he is, looming over it. There are only about a dozen pages talking about him, but except for his lack of personal religiosity, he's pretty much the king of Fantasyland currently.
And Stephen Colbert had a role in this, and maybe that will help you explain to the listeners just what Fantasyland's all about.
Yeah, in the very first episode of The Colbert Report, back when he was introducing his character on television on The Colbert Report, people now know his phrase truthiness. He introduced it on the first show. He had a whole essentially essay about what truthiness is, and as he defined it, it was you know things based on your gut feeling, and you can disregard facts. And if you want to decide that Panama Canal was finished in 1941 instead of 1914, that's fine because that's what you feel. And it was funny, and really back in 2005, it was a dozen years ago, but it was just at that moment when the ideas that make up this book and that I wanted to sort of track down and interrogate for this book were coming into focus for me, and I thought, yes, exactly. That is America in the 21st century.
And in a sense, that explains fake news. So many of my friends have a tough time understanding how somebody can believe something that everyone else around them knows is not true. But I think one of the things that you seem to point out in your book is that, hey, fake news is reality to a lot of folks. In fact, there's only a third of us who I think you claim in your book are reality-based.
Well, maybe a third, certainly less than half, are solidly reality-based. And we've always had an incredible, amazing diversity, not only of opinion in this country, but of views of how the world works, how reality itself works. But it really was kept in a kind of loose control by the establishments in various realms in politics and science and academia and religion, until starting, you know, in the 1960s, it wasn't kept under control so much. And then with the internet, we got to this place we got where every version of reality has its own set of media outposts, its websites, its radio shows, its television channels as well. So yeah, we've gotten to a point that we weren't before, that we weren't when I was young, say, in the 1960s, early 1960s, where there was a certain shared set of facts. And people still disagreed about what those facts meant, but they didn't, by and large, fundamentally disagree about the facts. And there was a big ruckus over Vietnam, some of your listeners may recall, back in the 60s and 70s. But nobody said, oh, no, there aren't 500,000 American troops fighting and dying there. That we agreed on the facts. We agreed that, yes, the communists were fighting are communists, and we have a lot of people over there. And then we hit each other and hated each other and disagreed over what to do about that. But we didn't disagree with the basic facts, as I'm afraid we do now more and more.
So you point out that America isn't unique when it comes to this idea of fantasy land, but I wonder if you could help us understand how America was uniquely destined to become fantasy land in this country.
Yeah, I think it is defining of who we are, all the various pieces that make it up, this extreme individualism, which in up to a point is a good thing. The fact that we were born of people from Europe, you know, leaving Native Americans aside, the English settlers who came here were the ones up in New England who wanted to basically thought they were coming to create or find the Garden of Eden and get ready for the millennium and the second coming of Christ any day. And then the ones in the South who were sure they were coming and finding El Dorado and would find gold for the taking and plucking on the ground in Virginia. And so those two sets of passionate, wishful believers that this was going to be great, this blank slate where none of them had ever been, was how we started. And as with so many of the things I describe in the history of Fantasyland, up to a point, fine. It's part of truly what made us great. We can be anything. We can write our own course here. We can invent a new country. Great, as long as, you know, the Thomas Jeffersons and John Adams and Abraham Lincolns of the world are sort of in control. So all of those things, this anti-establishment feeling that our fervent, zealous Protestant forebears brought with them to this country is part of what led to this idea that nobody can tell me what to believe. No bosses, no priests, no clergy, no experts. I can find it myself by reading closely and feeling it in my gut. So those things, which have been part of the American character, for better and worse, for several hundred years, finally, in my view, got out of control over the last few decades.
And let's talk about the consequences of fantastical thinking. And in your book, you spend some time talking, for example, about the anti-vaccine movement. And please, whatever else you'd like to throw in there.
Well, that's a good example, I think, of a thing that came along just as the internet came along. Literally, this fraudulent medical paper that was published in 1998, the very year that, say, Google was introduced. There was a sort of perfect storm aspect of that, where this idea that vaccines cause autism, which they do not, was spread widely. And even as the one medical paper was debunked and retracted and discredited, there was no stopping the belief, especially among people who had children who were on the autism Asperger spectrum, that there was a cause, that there was a cause. It was vaccines, and the U.S. government and the pharmaceutical industry were colluding to cover up that fact. And as a result, many, many, many more Americans than ever before stopped vaccinating their children as they entered school, which was a real problem and led to lots more illness and death, especially among children, but not just among children, in the first 10 years of this century. As a result, needlessly, because of this passionate belief that the people who didn't agree with the establishment medical consensus had it right, and there was a conspiracy that was damaging their children. That's a real problem, and it's one recent big problem where fantasies get out of control, but it's an important one. And what I say, I came across in the research for this book, and you'll know because you read it, and I repeat it again and again, this thing that Thomas Jefferson said about freedom of religion, that he doesn't care what his neighbor thinks. If his neighbor believes in no God or 20 gods, it's fine with him as long as it doesn't pick his pocket or break his leg. Exactly. That's the laissez-faire American way. As long as it doesn't pick my pocket or break my leg, cool, whatever you think. But more and more, these beliefs, like the idea that vaccines cause autism, do pick pockets and break legs, and that's where it's become problematic.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Kurt Anderson, author of Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, A 500-Year History. So along the way, in the 19th century and into the 20th, there were a number of developments in American history that you credit with encouraging and really inspiring fantasy land of today. I want you to touch on just a couple of them, P.T. Barnum, Buffalo Bill Cody, for example.
Yeah, part of my argument is not, various extreme religions are part of it, and this kind of ultra-individualism and anti-establishment feeling, but also the show business and the popular culture as it was really invented by Americans and that we immersed in it. P.T. Barnum, an amazing figure who, before he started his circus later in life, he was this guy who created this American Museum, it was called, in Manhattan, in New York, that had all kinds of real artifacts, like a museum, and then entirely fictional artifacts, like a mermaid that he claimed he'd leased. Even before he started the museum, he put on display a slave, an African-American woman slave whom he bought, who claimed she was 161 years old and had been George Washington's nanny. And he was just like, I don't know if it's true or false, but it's entertaining. And so he mingled that with the fake, all that fake stuff with real stuff and put it out there. And so he was a kind of pioneer in that mixing of the authentic and the entirely fictional as part of the American popular cultural diet. Buffalo Bill Cody, too, was an extraordinary figure, and a generation or two later, who knew P.T. Barnum, who, even as he was being an Indian scout, a soldier, a Medal of Honor winner, all these actual things in the West during the Indian Wars of the 1870s, he became famous when he was popularized in quasi-fictional journalism in the East Coast and began having this double career for a few years of he would go out and be in the Dakotas and Montana fighting Native Americans, and then come back to Chicago, New York, go on stage playing himself for some performances, and then go back and be the real thing. He did that for a few years until he then gave it up and said, "Nah, I'm going to spend the next 40 years of my life actually creating this world-traveling pageant called Buffalo Bill's Wild West," in which he reenacted his exploits and the entire migration and settling of the West for 40 years. So that mixing, that very self-conscious mixing of the real and the fictionalized version of the real, he was this extraordinary pioneer in doing. And long before there was, a Donald Trump on The Apprentice or Celebrity Apprentice playing a CEO and then becoming president on the basis of that, there was Buffalo Bill 100 and 150 years ago, sort of paving the way.
Recently, Trump honored the Navajo codebreakers, and I couldn't help but think of your book, Fantasyland, when I looked at the painting behind Trump as he's honoring these gentlemen. It was of Andrew Jackson, who removed the Cherokee from Georgia and North Carolina in the Trail of Tears.
Right. And as he was honoring these Native American heroes, of course, couldn't stop himself from using a racial slur effectively that he's used before against Senator Elizabeth Warren, Pocahontas, which after all comes mainly from fictional renditions of our founding settlers and their intercourse with Native Americans. So, yeah, as I say, I mean, he's my go-to sort of hashtag for Donald Trump when he does things like that is greatest self-parodist of all times, because You can't. I mean, it's automatic satire. There's nothing to say. Just look what he did.
The fantasy industrial complex. Help us understand your point there. But more importantly, I'd like you to talk a little bit about the role that movies play, which is really a more modern rendition of the old Buffalo Bill days in P.T. Barnum.
Right. Again, we started as no other country had done, creating this culture industry, this popular culture industry, beginning with P.T. Barnum, but then tabloid newspapers, and then the movie business and radio and all the rest. So there was this show business as we'd never seen, and the phrase show business was coined in this country starting around in the late 19th century. But then very quickly, very early on, as other realms of American life, journalism, the pharmaceutical industry in the form of patent medicine shows, and so many others kind of merged with entertainment. Religion itself, one of the great successes of American evangelism starting in the 1700s were preachers who understood that you had to entertain if you were gonna persuade and convert and make people feel the Holy Spirit. And so really forms of entertainment as nowhere else annexed more and more parts of American life and then business life in the 20th century. And yes, Hollywood movies themselves, and then we forget what an extraordinary change they represented in terms of how reality and fiction were blurred. There was nothing like this. It wasn't like seeing a play. Yeah, you knew those were just actors there on stage. Or it wasn't like reading a book where it was all in your imagination. Here were pictures of time being distorted, of people in other countries. It was extraordinary. And again, it wasn't only Americans watching movies, of course, but it was only America that created this entire city and industry based on the movie industry, and where Americans, as soon as motion pictures existed, were going to them hours and hours a week. Then we had television. So this movie television industry allowed Americans, as it did no other people on Earth, to immerse in these variously convincing, persuasive, immersive fictions for hours and hours a day. And by the way, the collateral industry of creating celebrity, the likes of which we'd never seen, with hundreds more celebrities than had ever existed, and people who were famous, who were celebrities, not for being a successful general or a successful industrialist or politician or writer or whatever, but for pretending to be somebody else on a screen. And everybody soon in this country wanted to be one of them, if not a great actor, famous for something. So those are the sort of Hollywood television and now video gaming industries, along with this need, sort of desperate desire for celebrity, became part of this defining American situation that I call Fantasyland.
I'm Bob Custer, a host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Kurt Anderson about his book Fantasyland. Disney. So how does Disneyfication contribute to the making of Fantasyland? And I'd like you to talk a little bit about the woman you met, who I believe is from Celebration, Florida, and works for Disney. It's such a perfect example of what we're talking about here.
Yeah. Well, she actually she worked for Disney for a while. And last I talked to her, she wasn't, because her mother said she needed a big girl job. And so she decided she needed a big girl job. Her parents decided to move to Celebration, this city that there's town on the edge of Disney World outside Orlando that Disney created in the 1990s. That would be this perfect Pleasantville town as it might have existed circa 1955. And it's undeniably lovely place. You know, if I were of a mind to live in Central Florida, I can definitely see Celebration being one of my top choices. But yeah, I spent a day talking to this family about why they wanted to essentially live in Disney World, in this perfect Disneyfied place, created, no longer owned by Disney. And she was intelligent and frank about her desire to have her life, her actual life, be more wonderfully make-believe than real. She liked the fake snow that they drop in the main streets of Celebration every hour on the hour at night during the Christmas season, and the fake leaves that they do in the fall and so forth. Unapologetically, that made her more happy to be there. And her only complaint about the town of Celebration is that it isn't more like Disney World and Disneyland. So I found that so interesting because she's not doing anybody any harm. She and her parents are living in this more or less benign fantasy world. But it's another example, you know, a somewhat extreme example, but not one that makes you go, oh, my God, what have we come to in and of itself, of how everybody can have these make-believe fantastical lifestyles as well as, you know, beliefs that can be more dangerous and problematic. So Disney, I mean, I have always loved Disneyland and the Disney theme parks, but I am of two minds about them. I'm ambivalent about them. The way that Walt Disney and his Imagineers and the people working for him created Main Street USA, especially this, not one of these total fantasy places that has no link to reality, but oh, it's a town like towns used to be, but it's better. That became, when it was invented and appeared in 1955, that became kind of the prototype for how we would then begin to redevelop our downtowns and build shopping centers and suburbs. And so that Disney idea that everything can and should be themed to make believe it's somewhere else on Earth or somewhere else in time, because that's entertaining and that's charming in some way, and that's more desirable than boring old normal 2000 whatever America, it transformed us. And again, not all to the bad. As I say, I'm happy for all the fake 19th century restaurants in my home in Brooklyn, New York, and I'm not immune to living those kinds of fantasies. But it has, the Disneyfication of life it has been a big transformer of America over the last half century.
But the danger here seems to be in what I think you referred to at one point in the book as our inner children, where adults get so immersed in these fantasies that they literally turn themselves into childlike thinkers, when in fact they're living lives in a civic community where there are responsibilities that are adult-like, not kid-like, not Mickey Mouse and Minnie.
Precisely. And again, in the 1960s, one of the mantras of the groovy countercultural 1960s was, oh no, find your inner child, nurture your inner child. Good, up to a point. But there are aspects, as we all know, if you've had a child or been one, that are not so great about childlike behavior, the selfishness, the impulsiveness, the, you know, tendency toward narcissism, all of those things are not good. And I think together with the I can wear blue jeans and tennis shoes until I die, and I can listen to rock music, and I can obsess over chocolate chip ice cream and cookies, all those formerly childlike behaviors that are in and of themselves perfectly fine. But I think it does extend to other parts of life that enable and empower adults to behave childishly to the detriment of civic society.
So I don't want to let the academic disciplines off the hook here. Why don't you help us with what in the 80s and 90s some of these academic disciplines did to create this relativism where anything goes?
Yeah, that really started in the 60s and blossomed and took over a large part of American academia in the 80s and 90s. And it's not so much the moral relativism that I'm talking about, which conservatives have so long complained about academia doing, although it's a connected problem. What I find troubling and what I talk about in Fantasyland is the degree to which science and reason, starting in the 60s and extending ever since, have been subordinated as having no special privilege over fantasy, fantastical belief, magical belief, that we in the West cannot presume to say that reason and science are any different than the magical beliefs that other cultures or people in our own culture might hold. That's a problem. When we get so relativistic about these basic shared sets of facts about how the world works, how biological evolution happens, how climate change does or doesn't happen, and so forth. That change, which really had important wellsprings on campuses, has led not so much as the right worried about for so long as they were railing against what was going on campuses, but has redounded to the benefit more and more consequentially, I think, so far, to forces on the right, as I mentioned with climate change. But I think there's a connection in all of these problem areas that I talk about of I don't trust the establishment anymore, and I don't trust science because we've been taught for 50 years starting on the campuses that we didn't need to, and therefore I'm not going to believe the experts about the dangers or lack of dangers of vaccines. So that, especially in the social, in all of the social sciences in academia, and again, it's not as though every professor or even most of them in most of the social scientific fields are guilty of what I'm talking about. But there is much guilt and much culpability in academia. And one can spend a whole book, and people have, highlighting those dangerous, slippery slope slides into nothing's truer than anything else. And, you know, whatever you want to decide is true is fine, because all of reality is just a social construction. Yeah. That leads to dangerous places.
What struck me was, again, as you point out, you've only given a very few examples, and there probably aren't that many great examples like you've given in the book, but the extent to which some of our nation's finest universities, most reputable universities, have legitimized some of this nonsense and given these faculty chairs and protected them in ways that would have surprised me. But let's move on to one final question I've got, and we're just about out of time. You say at the end, Kurt, that you don't really want to give an actionable agenda, but you do say there are ways we can slow the flood and repair the levees when it comes to this movement toward fantasy land. Tell us what you think.
Well, certainly people like you and me who have some our little platforms for planting the flag and saying reason and empirical reality and facts have a real importance, and we should cling to them and not say, you're entitled to your own opinion about everything. But even all of us in our own families, I think, have a role to play in not letting the friend or the brother-in-law spouting some preposterous conspiracy theory get away with that unchallenged. Again, we don't have to become necessarily constant jerks at the holiday table saying, no, Joe, that's not true. George Soros does not want to take your Camaro away. But I think we all have a role, as in all these things. I'm certainly not suggesting that, you know, by government fiat, we tell Facebook it can't propagate fake news. But there are things that Facebook and other social media platforms can do to reduce that problem. But just each of us in his or her own life with our own children and grandchildren and can encourage a kind of sense of care about how we deal with facts and non-facts, and check ourselves, interrogate ourselves, bust ourselves when we fall prey, as almost all of us do sometime, to spouting some set of alternative facts or doubting actual facts because they're inconvenient to what we wish to be true politically or for other reasons.
Kurt Anderson, thank you for writing Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire, a 500-year history. You've done a great job of summing this book up, but it's over 400 pages long, and I will say it again, of all the books that we've done this year, this is one I think everybody needs to read right now. Thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much. A pleasure talking to you.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Kurt Anderson. Next week, Amor Towles, author of the best-selling novel, A Gentleman in Moscow. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed some of our recent shows, including my conversation with Sally Bedell Smith about her book about Prince Charles, you'll find them on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org. Or download our free app from Google Play or the App Store to listen to previous interviews anytime, anywhere.